Spirit Blade Underground, October 22nd, 2010.
Warning, access restricted, enter password, DNA verification, processing, verification complete, access granted, welcome.
Spirit Blade Underground, October 22nd, 2010.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast. I'm Peter Franson, the creator of Spirit Blade Productions. We're bringing you Christian sci-fi and fantasy that's unsterilized, unsafe, and unleashed on your ears and imagination. You can check out what we're doing and grab lots of cool downloads over at www.spiritblade.net. Well, I know I say this quite a bit, but we do have a really packed show today, so we got to get straight into updates.
File access. Updates.
Well, now that the Spirit Blade Special Edition has launched, I head into what is possibly my least favorite part of my work. That's the what I call the marketing phase, if you will. Granted, I always kind of have marketing on the back burner and have to keep it going. And what do I mean by marketing? Well, basically just kind of getting the word out about the product, you know, and just trying to get coverage, exposure, or whatever in different places. So I always kind of have to keep that going on the back burner. But after the launch of a product, I usually spend at least a few weeks doing almost nothing but writing and sending emails and trying to set up interviews and other types of correspondence. The one difference this time around is that because of the special edition, I am now proud of every product in our library and feel much more confident in presenting the Spirit Blade series to people. Which reminds me, I am offering a free download of Spirit Blade Special Edition to anyone who will agree to review it or interview me on their podcast before the end of November. I am also offering free downloads to writers of established review or appropriately themed blogs that agree to review Spirit Blade Special Edition or do a text interview, that's fine too, on their blog before the end of November. If you fit either of these categories and want a free download of the project, be sure to let me know. Email me at Pater, P-A-E-T-E-R, at spiritblade.net. Really a pretty easy way to get yourself a download of the Spirit Blade Special Edition. And for those of you who haven't purchased a copy yet, I've added a new feature to the online store. I did that earlier this week. Combos, specifically CD download combos. If you've ever been torn between getting a physical CD and enjoying one of our audio dramas right away, well, now you can do both. For both Spirit Blade Special Edition and Spirit Blade Dark Ritual, you can now buy the CD sets and get the digital downloads for just $2.99 extra. Likewise, if you just want the download for yourself but would also like to give a CD as a gift, this is a really cost-effective way to do both at once. You can check out your options at spiritblade.net. Blah, blah, blah. See, I told you that I had entered the marketing phase. It's been a good week, and I've enjoyed the progress I've been able to make on the audiobook of Spirit Blade. Even the marketing side of things has been pretty bearable, I think. But for those who aren't aware, I will probably be dropping off the radar soon for about a week or two. There will probably be no podcast next week. I think I am going to put something in the feed, just as a little bit of housekeeping stuff. I'm going to put a preview of Dark Ritual, like a 30... Actually, I think it's a 40, a little over 40-minute preview of Dark Ritual on there. Currently, I'm hosting that file on the server of the website, but as I want to put more and more behind-the-scenes content there, if I find another place that I can host that content without, like, making it just Creative Commons and it can go anywhere, you know, then the podcast feed is one way that I can do that, and they'll just archive it for me and keep it forever. So anyway, there will be no podcast, I don't think, next week, but there will be probably something in the feed. If you've never heard Dark Ritual before, then stick around and listen to the 40-minute preview. You might find it interesting. But otherwise, you can just plan on skipping next week. I'm pretty sure there will not be a podcast. The reason why? Well, my wife is expecting to deliver our second child any day now. I don't anticipate any interruption of services for those who purchase from our online store, whether it's digital downloads or physical product, but I will likely be dropping nearly everything else I do here for a little while as our world kind of gets turned upside down for a little bit. The podcast, yeah, like I said, it'll be off next week. I don't anticipate 2 weeks in a row being off, but next week I'm pretty sure there will be no podcast. There's no signs of labor yet, but if I suddenly seem to vanish, my online presence, you know, if I don't answer emails or whatever, if I just kind of vanish in the coming days and go off the radar for a week or two, you'll know why. It's not because I hate you. It's because my wife popped and this thing came out and we got to, like, keep it alive now. So anyway, we got a lot of stuff on the show today. I got two submitted reviews, one retro review, and another for, what is it, Paranormal Activity 2. I've got a review for Red, and then we're going to be looking again at the Book of Romans. Just a ton of stuff, so we better get to it.
Primary features.
Movie reviews.
I don't like horror movies. I never have. However, when I was 12 years old, I dared to watch Night of the Living Dead, and it scared me more than the thought of Sean William Scott winning an Oscar. Made in 1968, this movie didn't create the concept of zombies so much as that it repopularized and defined them for a modern audience, much as J.R.R. Tolkien did for the fantasy genre. Zombie movies before this one certainly had existed, but the zombies had always been mindless servants of some evil master, more often than not, Bela Lugosi. In Night of the Living Dead, however, there is no master, no grand scheme, no evil plot whatsoever. Frankly, there's barely a reason at all that these zombies exist. They simply are, and they simply are
hungry.
If you're curious about the plot, just read the title, Night of the Living Dead. That's it. That's the plot. It's one night with a group of infighting people trying to survive hordes of incoming voracious monsters. And to think that this movie came out before the Star Trek cast was even doing the convention circuit. Incidentally, just a side question for you. Where did the notion that zombies want to just eat our brains come from? And I'm serious here. If anyone knows zombie movies and knows, please, my name is Duna Dwarf on the forum. Let me know, because I'm curious. Because in this movie, the zombies eat the whole buffalo, with us being the buffalo, except for maybe the eyeballs. I think that's what makes these zombies really so frightening. It's not that they're all wounded and grotesque, it's that they're not. There are a few messed up looking zombies, are all, you know, horrible, nasty, but most of them just look like regular people. They're just walking weird, and if they get a hold of you, they'll eat you alive. I mean, they look like that in the original version. I don't know if in the colorized version, if they turn their skin green or some weird color or do something, but in the original black and white, they just look like regular people. They look like your neighbors. Most of them look so normal that if you took a still image from the movie, they just look like a regular person who'd maybe had a little too much cheese. They might be unhappy, but they're hardly undead. I don't know if this is deliberate or if it's a result of budget problems like on Jaws, but like on Jaws, it works. No matter how good the makeup in a movie, on some level we all recognize that a made-up creature is just that, made up. We already disbelieve on some level because we know it's not possible. In reality, here in America at least, most people who die, even if it's a horrible, violent, terrible death, they're clean, they're dressed in a nice suit, they're buried. Most of the Walking Dead look like your neighbors, and that adds to the believability and therefore adds to the horror. Picture this. Some mutilated corpse attacks you and tries to devour you. That's pretty horrific. But if the Finkelsteins from next door suddenly come over and try to rip you apart and eat your still twitching limbs and digits, that's a whole new level of messed up. While we're on the subject of reality, there's a big elephant in the room of this house where we spend the titular night. Writer-director George Romero has said that there is social commentary in the movie, but he shrewdly never delineated just what that commentary was. Is it racial commentary? Is it the Vietnam War? This was 1968 again, remember. There's a number of social issues it can be about, and it's about as brilliant as not goring the zombies up because it lets people discuss and debate the message instead of just having it slammed into their face. Honestly, I'm ambiguous about this movie. On one level, I do appreciate the skill that went into it and the foundational impact it had on zombie movies, or really any story focused on people defending from hordes of attackers. On the other hand, even after years of time to grow, and with the Riff Trax guy's jokes to soften it up, it still weirds me out. If you do watch this movie, take my suggestion and do not watch it right before you go to bed. Either that or maybe I'm just a weenie. This Halloween, if you're going to check out a horror flick, why not try out a classic? As a bonus, Night of the Living Dead is a public domain film, which means that you can legally download it in full. No one owns the rights to it at all. It's a public domain film. I can't promise that you'll like it or that you'll hate it, but you will remember it.
Awesome review, Duna Dwarf. Thanks so much for sending that in. Yeah, that is curious. You bring up the idea of zombies. When do they start loving brains and why and what's that all about? I don't know. Maybe they just kind of sense that they're extremely stupid and in their stupid state think that eating brains will help fix that problem. I don't know. But I remember the first time I saw Night of the Living Dead, it wasn't, I mean, it was recent relatively in my life. I saw it maybe, I want to say like 6 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, and watched it with the former worship pastor at a church, friend of mine. Actually, it was Mickey Bryce, who plays Isaiah. He was like, "You've never seen Night of the Living Dead?" And so, "Oh, we got to watch that." So we sat down and watched it. And it was disturbing, more so than I thought. There were colorized movies, of course, when this movie came out, but Romero chose to do it in black and white. I don't know if it was related to the blood, because he could go cheaper on the blood, you know. If it was black and white, he could use something that didn't have to look as real, you know, because it wouldn't be in color or what. But there's something disarming about the black and white color that I don't, maybe on a subconscious level, makes me think, well, it's black and white. This movie isn't going to be that messed up. But it's messed up. It's a messed up movie. And so, yeah, I agree. There is kind of like, even though it's dated, even though there's some things that you could look now and say, oh, they could do that better, whatever, there is something unsettling about it. And for me, I think it's related to the fact that it's in black and white. The fact that it's a public domain movie, don't let that sway you from thinking, well, it must be crap if it's in the public domain. Go check it out. If nothing else, if you're like a film buff, this is a movie that you've got to see. So I definitely put my thumbs up behind at least the idea of seeing it if you haven't before and you're kind of a movie buff. All right, next up, we've got a review for Paranormal Activity 2 by untold author Nathan James Norman.
This is Nathan James Norman for the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast, reviewing Paranormal Activity 2. Taking place 3 months before the events of the first movie, Paranormal Activity 2 follows Christy and Dan as they bring home their new baby. After their home is ransacked, but not burglarized, Dan has an elaborate system of cameras installed throughout their home. Then, what begins as an ominous feeling the superstitious nanny senses slowly begins to turn into odd thumps, which leads to pots and pans falling off their racks, and the frequent night terrors of Hunter, their firstborn son. Knowing that I would be reviewing this, I watched the original film a couple of nights ago. That's right, I said night. And my wife is out of town for the week, so it was just me. And I have to tell you, nearly everything that happened in the first movie happened to me that very night. I heard loud thumping in the dead of night. Doors opened and closed. And these bite marks appeared on my body. Of course it wasn't demons. It was my cats, going nuts all night long. But this isn't a slam against the first movie. In fact, it's high praise. All the demonic activities are things we've experienced. Shadows out of the corner of our eyes, or an oddly placed set of keys. And no one pays too close attention to these sorts of mundane occurrences. The horror of the first Paranormal Activity is that by the time you realize that all is not well with your life, it's almost too late to stop the evil presence. The first movie worked because all the supernatural occurrences were realistic. The found, quote-unquote, home videos of these events were raw and unrefined, and the actors were unknown and unrefined average people. Paranormal 2, however, does not work. Whereas the first film had a budget of a mere $15,000, this movie had a budget of $3 million. Also, the first film had actors no one had ever seen before, and the presence of Sprague Grayden from Jericho and 24 and some other places immediately unmasked the illusion that this movie could quite possibly happen to real people. And as I've already praised the very believable and horrifying manifestations in the first film, the manifestations in this film are too Hollywood and not all that believable. I never once thought, oh, what if demons make my baby levitate out of his crib? Or, is the spirit playing with my children's toys? Or, I hope demons don't take my automated pool vacuum cleaner out of the water every night! The horror. Right. You see, the Lovecraftian horror that the first film stimulated came from the eerie sense that these supernatural things really do happen. But there's nothing we can do to stop them. We are totally and utterly powerless. In Paranormal Activity 2, what few scary moments there are come from the sort of gotcha moments that occur when absolutely nothing happens for 20 minutes. No sound, no music, little dialogue, and suddenly a loud bang rattles the character. Now, with all that said, this new film and the first are fantastic conversation starters. I mean, just telling people that I was going to review this film has led to numerous conversations about the supernatural. And here's the absolute truth. And this is why these movies are so frightening. Well, the first one at least. You and I are totally powerless against supernatural forces. If a man breaks into my house, I can club him with my maglite, get into a fist fight, or call the police, or run away. But what can you do if a demon is tormenting you? Are you going to think pleasant thoughts? Or sleep only during the day? No. You and I are powerless. That is, unless you are a Christ follower. Because then, you are sealed with the Holy Spirit. And you have the authority of Jesus himself to command supernatural evil to leave. I've had this conversation with no less than a dozen people in the last 2 days. People who are genuinely concerned and interested in this topic. So, because of that, I'm going to go ahead and give Paranormal Activity 2 a relevancy rating of 9.5 out of 10. The film itself gets a quality rating of a 3 out of 10. I don't think there's any surprises there. So if you like genuine horror, go see the first film. Avoid the second. And if you fear the supernatural, turn to Jesus. And if you don't want to turn to Jesus, get a cat and blame the cat for all the creepy things that happen in your house.
Cool. Thanks so much for sending in that review, Nathan. I was kind of curious about it. I knew that there'd be a chance that people would be interested in seeing it, but I just didn't quite have it in me to go see it. I enjoyed the first one, you know, to a degree, and but I just wasn't feeling motivated to go see the second one. I was more interested in seeing a Hereafter this week. But what a bummer to hear that Paranormal Activity 2 kind of sucks. But it sounds like, yeah, it sounds like a great conversation starter. Very cool. Thanks so much, Nathan. I did see Hereafter today. I'm not doing a review on it, partly because it's the time issue, and also partly because it's not quite, it doesn't quite have the geek appeal that I was hoping it would. It's not like a What Dreams May Come, if you saw that with Robin Williams and Cuba Gooding Jr., where it was this very visual fantasy type supernatural life after death kind of movie, which has a lot of whack out philosophy going on driving it, and this one definitely had, you know, Hereafter definitely had whacked out philosophy driving it, but it just wasn't spending hardly any time at all showing us glimpses of the spirit world or the afterlife or stuff like that. It was largely a just kind of a human drama, a human story, but talk about conversation starters. If you know, sometime, if maybe when it comes out on a DVD, I'll bring it up again. I did take some notes in case I want to do a review of it in the future, but sometime it would be fun on this show, maybe to explore just kind of the near-death experiences and kind of the anecdotal evidence that's brought up for that, and kind of how that whole system and conceptually kind of breaks down. In a nutshell, hereafter, the movie is all about resolving feelings and not about finding truth. All of it hinges on, I want to resolve these feelings for these various characters. They're not looking for truth. They just want to feel good. Very interesting, and of course, a very, I think, dangerous way to investigate things as important as where we go when we die. So, but anyway, it's an interesting movie, but if you're looking for like a supernatural movie, Hereafter is not where you want to go. But I did see earlier this week the movie Red. Now, I normally only review movies with clear geek appeal, and action movies are, you know, they're not uniquely enjoyed by geeks. This movie didn't have any sci-fi elements in it or anything like that, but since Red is based on a comic published by DC, I figured it has just enough connection to geek culture to warrant a review since I had the time. As is ironically often the case, I seem to be saying this a lot, given my comic book fanaticism, I have not read the original DC comic, and so am reviewing this movie based only on its own merits. Red features an ensemble cast led by Bruce Willis, playing former CIA black operative Frank Moses. Each person in this group of protagonists is former something, CIA, KGB, MI6, etc., that kind of thing. And they were all the best at what they did. Well, now they're all retired, but someone is looking to knock them all off to clean up a mess from a mission they were all a part of in the 80s. Dragged along for the action is Frank's would-be girlfriend, who he has been talking to on the phone for months, but meets for the very first time just as people start trying to kill him. This movie is fun from beginning to end. Plenty of laughs to be had as these unusual characters interact with each other. John Malkovich, in particular, is well cast in his role as former experimental test subject. He can be a guy that, you know, if the role is not right for him, it's just like I thought it was in Jonah Hex. I thought that was terrible casting for John Malkovich. But this role is great for John Malkovich. But the laughs, you know, don't equate to a lack of intensity or danger in this movie. Until nearly the last frame of this movie, I was concerned for all of our heroes and never felt kind of safe, you know. In this regard, the tone of the movie is a fantastic balance of action and humor. In the first half of the movie, there are some extremely cool visuals incorporating slow motion, at least one of which I have never seen anything like before. I won't spoil it, but it involves a spinning car, slow motion, Bruce Willis, and you'll know it when you see it. I think they even show a glimpse of it in the trailer, but you want to see the full moment there, the full shot there to appreciate. It's really cool. And Frank Moses uses some cool MacGyver-like ideas once or twice that I found surprising and clever. The second half of the movie changes significantly from the first, however. Right around the halfway point, things suddenly become slower and less explosive. The plot is moving forward nicely, but creative action visuals are nearly dried up by halftime. What starts as a wild action flick settles into a spy espionage movie. I think they might have been better off starting with that feel and placing the best visuals and action in the second half. That seems like a natural progression to me. As it is, the movie really loses momentum noticeably after the halfway point, I think. The movie doesn't lend itself to much worthwhile discussion, though in one exchange of note, Frank's girlfriend says that people are basically decent, to which he replies, "That hasn't been my experience." The idea that people are basically decent or basically good is a common belief in pop culture. The problem is that the definitions of basically and good are both left unexamined when this statement is made, resulting in a false sense of self-righteousness, or maybe a better way to say it would be self-security in your own kind of decency and goodness. Although one could argue that Frank's experience does not represent the norm because he's interacting with, you know, people that are either trying to kill him or he's trying to kill because they're bad or whatever, I still appreciated some form of counter-argument being presented in response to this all too quickly ingested assumption. Although it missed some opportunities to create something really incredible, Red is a fun action flick with a few really cool visuals and some really enjoyable characters. It's rated PG-13 for intense sequences of action, violence, and brief, strong language. I give it a quality of 8.5 out of 10 and a relevance of 6.0 out of 10. You know, I haven't talked about comic books in a while here. I also, at some point in the future, want to kind of get caught up on, you know, upcoming movie news and stuff like that. But I know I haven't talked about comic books in a little while. So I want to talk a little bit about the Justice League. I have collected every JLA comic since Grant Morrison rebooted the franchise for DC Comics in the late 90s with his kind of Big Seven team, which consisted of Superman, Batman, Flash, Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, and Martian Manhunter. And I also agree. I think those are... Well, I don't know. I'm probably forgetting somebody. But I think that's for, if you're going to go with the top seven, that's a pretty good roster. For years, this was one of the best titles to read, featuring the most iconic heroes of the DCU. But in recent years, this trend changed. Various writers came and went, some of whom DC probably thought would be great for the book, but turned out to be duds. Likewise, the art began to suffer more and more. It just got rough and sloppy. It seemed as though DC forgot that a book like this deserves top talent behind the wheel. In the last 3 years specifically, the team roster changed and began to feature third and fourth string characters like Vixen and Red Tornado, and the latest reboot by James Robinson that started with the Cry for Justice miniseries began adding the likes of Starman, and I'm talking about the alien one that no one remembers, and Kong Gorilla in the lineup. And yeah, I'd never heard of Kong Gorilla either. Although the story was fairly solid in the Cry for Justice miniseries, it seems that Robinson is kind of operating on Grant Morrison's Final Crisis playbook, using obscure, long-forgotten characters, and assuming we all know and care about who they are. I dropped the book, the ongoing book, after one issue of Robinson's run, because things didn't look like they'd be getting any better. Meanwhile, I've had problems with the Justice Society book for similar reasons. The lineup, actually, I thought was fine. The writing was terrible. But the creative team on that book is changing this month, and I've been curious about the crossover storyline that James Robinson wrote in both books in recent months, which featured Alan Scott, the Golden Age Green Lantern, and Obsidian and Jade, his son and daughter. I also listened to the convention panels for DC at the San Diego Comic-Con about a month or so ago, and it sounds like Robinson's JLA book is selling very well, and that he'll be on it along with his second string lineup for a while to come. Now, I'm no grump. There may not currently be a what I would call a proper Justice League of America book to read. But if Robinson, you know, it's kind of like the third Halloween movie. It's like, hey, where's Michael Myers? He's kids got these weird head reprogramming, whatever, rotting their skulls in masks they bought at Walmart. But where's Michael? This doesn't seem like a Halloween movie. I kind of feel the same way about this James Robinson's run on Justice League. It's like, okay, you got all these second stringers. Where's the people that actually make this the Justice League? So anyway, there might not be what I would call a proper JLA book to read. But if Robinson really is telling good stories about DC Comics heroes, then I want to read them. Even if a book like the one he's writing, has no business being called Justice League of America, which I don't think it does. Last weekend, my comic book store had a crazy sale, 50% off everything in the store. A perfect opportunity to get caught up cheaply on a few back issues and give James Robinson a real chance to prove himself to me with two complete story arcs. In the hardcover collection titled Team History, Robinson spends about 6 issues modifying the roster almost every issue with a, quote, story featuring obscure villains who are never introduced properly. The art is okay, but takes some getting used to. It's not as polished as I think it should look for a book like this. And like I said, story I put in quotes, it was, I don't know where it was going or the plot, if there was one, was very hard to find. I've just started the next story arc. I got to update this. I read the entire Dark Things storyline that James Robinson wrote. He took over Justice Society as well as his normal duties for Justice League for a few months and wrote a storyline called Dark Things that featured Alan Scott and Obsidian and Jade, as I mentioned. Every aspect of this storyline was much improved over his initial six issues in the Justice League Monthly. And I don't think it was just because it featured, you know, Green Lantern and characters from the Green Lantern mythos, which I'm a huge fan of. The story moved forward logically, and he had some great character moments that convinced me that he's been doing his homework. The art was also improved overall, I thought, gaining some needed polish in both the lines and coloring. I'm still not a fan of talking animals in the DCU and have zero interest in getting to know Kongorilla more deeply, but the new, or old if you will, Starman may have some potential if they can dish out backstory and character, you know, and enrich and give, you know, three dimensions to his character in good portions, then I think there's some potential there. The story was also aided by featuring so many great well-known Justice Society characters, you know, not just Alan Scott Green Lantern, but like the whole cast of Justice Society, really, you know, some really great well-known characters. Hopefully Robinson's Justice League book will still hold up when it's back to featuring only his cast of former Teen Titans and obscure DC oddities. So in this realm, you can color me cautious but hopeful.
The future. A world with a quest for truth is a thing of the past.
Look, your truth just isn't true for me, okay?
The truth does not require your belief. It simply is, regardless of your personal convictions.
I think the world's been blinded, Ebony. Everybody claims to be spiritual, whatever the drac that means, but nobody really knows anything about the spiritual world.
Merrick, this is crazy. You can't talk like this.
And they'll do anything to keep it out of our future.
It's Atlantis! They found us again!
An alien race has blessed us with amazing technology.
Merrick, the world we live in is incredible.
While a race of demons destroys who we are.
Do you believe in the supernatural, Mr. Vandarius?
He shall bathe in your blood, human.
Brothers, tonight marks the end of our subjection to the only. Humanity will be wiped from the map of history.
We've traveled across our world and even into another.
What we can see with our eyes is of little consequence in the grand scheme of things. It is what occurs in the other world around us that should have us concerned.
What the frizz just happened? Was that the
other world?
We've been hunted by humans, aliens, and things I don't have a name for.
I'm the future, Vincent. The ultimate life form.
There's too many of them! One goes down and three more take its place!
All because we're looking for the one weapon that can bring an end to this conflict forever.
Give me the sword!
A weapon known only as the Spirit Blade.
Oh, I can feel its power from here!
Oh yeah? Well, tell me what this feels like.
For more information, visit spiritblade.net.
Every word of God proves true. The grass withers and the flowers fade, but the word of our God stands forever.
Today we're searching for truth in the book of Romans, chapter 3, verses 9 through 18. I'm going to read it again from the New American Standard version of the Bible, which says, "What then? Are we better than they? Not at all, for we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become useless. There is none who does good. There is not even one. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues they keep deceiving. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their paths, and the path of peace have they not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes." Have you ever heard someone say, "I think people are basically good"? You know, I mentioned that in my review of the movie Red, that this idea that people are basically decent or basically good. You know, maybe you've heard this sentiment in a movie or a TV show or spoken by a celebrity or even a news commentator. The thought is a common one, and in one sense, it may be true. If we define good as not raping and killing people, then we might at least get away with saying that most people are basically good. But is this the way that good is defined? Well, if God truly exists and is the source of all good, as the Bible teaches, then He defines good, and our opinions about what we collectively think good means won't matter. In quoting various Old Testament verses, Psalm 14, 1 through 3, 1 Kings 8, 46, Psalm 130, verse 3, Psalm 143, verse 2, Proverbs 29, and that's 20, verse 9, excuse me, and Ecclesiastes 7, 20. In quoting various Old Testament verses, that's what this is kind of a compilation of Old Testament verses, Paul paints a brutally honest portrait of the natural human condition. This is the state of things when God does not intervene and clean up the mess you and I have made and continue to make of our lives. This is kind of a summary of what Paul says here. We are not in good standing with God. We don't understand what God teaches or have any interest in finding out who God is. We have turned away from God and live pointless lives. None of us do anything good. Corrupt and rotten words and ideas are constantly coming out of our mouths. We repeatedly lie to each other and hurt each other with our comments. We express hatred and festering bitterness to each other. We're quick to start fights and even kill. Our natural patterns lead to destruction and pain, both emotionally and physically. The idea of life lived in contentment is foreign to us. We don't have any respect or reverence for God. Now, this assessment might seem pretty harsh, given that we may not know anyone who seems to fit this description, but Jesus provides insight to God's perspective on goodness. He taught that anger is often equal to murder, and lustful thoughts are equal to adultery. Look at Matthew chapter 5. Likewise, God said to the prophet Samuel that man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. That's 1 Samuel 16:7. And Jesus said that no one is good except for God alone. That's found in Mark 10, verse 18. Isaiah said that even the good things we attempt to do are like filthy rags. You see that in Isaiah 64, verse 6. And a little bit of trivia here. The phrase filthy rags, as it appears there, literally, refers to menstrual cloths. Think of a used tampon and you'll get an appropriate image of our individual attempts at being good. If this is true, if God's standard is so vastly higher and different from ours, then the comparisons we make to ourselves and others to decide what good is or kind of how we stack up, it all needs to be thrown out the window. We should acknowledge that we may have no idea what it really means to be, quote, good. Every single one of us falls hopelessly short, regardless of religion, sexual practice, ethnicity, political leanings, or culture. We are all in the same boat unless God fixes our mess. And next week, we're going to take a look at how God makes it possible to clean up our mess. The Coffee House question for this week, why do you think it is so difficult to acknowledge that even our goodness is vile and disgusting? Why is it so important for us to feel as though we are basically good? You can respond to that or anything else on your mind by emailing me at paeter@spiritblade.net or give me a call and leave a message I can play on the podcast at 206-350-1226. Well, there's not quite enough time for me to get into it on the podcast today, but over at the forums, spiritblade.net/forums, one listener brought up a really valid point. You know, I talked about Hugh Ross's book, Beyond the Cosmos, a week or two ago. I can't remember how long ago it was, and I've been, I think, on the forums as well, in discussion forums. I've just brought up that book several times. I think it's really cool and worth checking out. Basically, the author brings the discussion of higher dimensional theory into looking at God, how we look at God, how God could interact with His creation, which exists in, or at least the physical creation exists in four dimensions, you know, This guy, Hugh Ross, is also known for his views on what's called progressive creationism, which is an old Earth view, and as opposed to the literal 7-day, 24-hour period view. One podcast listener said, "Hey, I don't know if you knew, but this guy, you know, he's got these ideas out there and stuff like that." And I am aware that his thinking on the creation is controversial to some folks. And I don't have time to kind of get into my response to that, but we had a really great conversation. And anybody that kind of like something, you know, kind of triggered like a red flag went up. Hugh Ross, when I mentioned Hugh Ross, go over to spiritblade.net/forums and go to the section that's the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, and you'll see there a reference to the coffeehouse question, or I can't remember what it is, but it's one of the top two or three topics there. So if you kind of want to know what my feelings are about Hugh Ross and creationism and stuff like that, and his view on progressive creationism, you can jump over there and check that out, and add to the discussion if you want. Good things going on over the forums, guys. If you haven't visited there yet, I would love to connect with you there. Once again, spiritblade.net/forums. That's it for this week. Next week, like I said, it's a good chance that there will be no podcast. I'm going to probably upload the Dark Ritual preview so that I can clear up some space on the server for the main website, so I can put some more special features up there. That's it. So anyway, if you can think of it, you can be praying for me and my wife, Holly. She's due basically by the time you hear this, she's probably past due. we just want this boy to be born healthy and for the delivery to go well. Hope you guys have a great week. I don't know what you guys are facing, if you got any challenges coming up that you are aware of. But I hope that you and I, in whatever we're facing, can in those moments remember to value and seek out the truth.
Visit www.spiritblade.net. Peter is a crazy freak. Green Lantern is awesome. Visit www.spiritblade.net.